content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the New Yorker magazine, edition April 9th, 2018. To begin today's broadcast, I'll read a poem by Maxine Skates entitled The Orchards. There were problems to be solved then, decisions to be made. And now we walk and walk through the orchards, the cannery orchard, the nursery orchard, the black cherry orchard. We walk to the river, the far boundary, high and wide, deep and brown, a ganglia of branches tumbling, shooting down the rapids, then caught by the branch of a downed tree. There's a man sitting on a bench aiming a long lens, an old couple walking who stopped to pet our young dog. The nursery orchard makes me think of how the decisions quieted, moved on. How long ago I'd take those tests in secret, and never the right color, I thought it was him. Later I found out it was both of us, and oddly that made it better, our decision made. The young trees in this orchard were grown for transplant, or maybe they just took cuttings, because now they're as gnarled as the tree in the meadow they call the wedding tree, which was split in a storm, its fallen branches scattered around the still living base. It's the goat orchard I keep wondering about, though. Did the goats run there the way the dogs do now in their endless loops? Last night I saw a photo of goats standing in the branches of a tree they climb to eat its nuts. At first they looked much too heavy to ride the branches, 10 of them standing in the same tree, and then they looked as light as horned birds. So yes, the decisions lessen, but the problems remain. The one about the heart, the way it rises. The one about finding your way to it as if walking in a maze of so many orchards. Each one needs a name. And now, from the Talk of the Town, Social Studies Department, an essay entitled Chat Room by Andrew Marantz. In 1727, when Benjamin Franklin was 21, he and a few friends, among them a scrivener, a joiner, and two cobblers, formed a conversation club called the Junto. They met on Friday evenings at a Philadelphia alehouse. The rules that I drew up required that every member in his turn should produce one or more queries on any point of morals, politics, or natural philosophy to be discussed by the company, Franklin wrote in his autobiography. The United States was not yet the United States, but already he sensed a civility problem. His solution, structured, secular chit-chat, quote, conducted in the sincere spirit of inquiry about after truth, without fondness for dispute or desire of victory, end quote. Those were the days. I don't think anyone, anywhere on the political spectrum, thinks our civic discourse is in good shape right now, Asha Curran said recently, around the time that a sitting president and a former vice president were publicly threatening to beat each other up. Curran is the chief innovation officer at the 92nd Street Y, which is both a building on the Upper East Side and a nonprofit encouraging, quote, American pluralism, end quote, and participation in civic life. She and her boss, who had recently read Franklin's autobiography, started discussing discussion clubs. We asked, what does the modern version of a junto look like, Curran said. It ended up looking like BenFranklinCircles.org. A website that offers a few printable conversation prompts and a video trailer. The concept is simple. You gather a small group to talk about big ideas. There are now about 150 Ben Franklin circles around the country, one at a homeless shelter in Detroit, one at the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. A local citizen seeking communion within a reasonable commute radius joined a circle on the Upper West Side. It was a Wednesday night, not a Friday, but the group continued the tradition of meeting at an alehouse. Well, a modern Mediterranean tavern with maize and $8 IPAs. Convening the circle, which was actually more of a thin parallelogram owing to the restaurant's long tables, was Clay Williams of the Bronx, who wore a dark sports coat, an orange t-shirt, and a diamond stud in each ear. He calls himself a holistic lifestyle expert, specializing in personal and professional development. Half life coach, half makeover consultant. Each circle discussion centers on one of Franklin's 13 virtues, a list of personal attributes worth striving for, one of Franklin's many attempts at life coaching. The night's theme was the second virtue, silence. "Is there any way you could turn the music down just a bit?" Williams asked the manager. A techno remix of Sade's Smooth Operator throbbed in the background, or really the foreground. "I was planning to start off with a silent meditation," Williams said. "But instead, I think I'll spark a discussion around how can you get to a silent place when you're surrounded by distraction." The participants arrived, a freelance editor in her 50s, an opera singer, a university administrator, and a church fundraiser, all in their 40s, a woman who was about to leave management consulting to become a midwife, and Williams' boyfriend, a middle school science teacher. "We're in a noisy spot, clearly, but just close your eyes quickly and ask yourself what silence means to you," Williams said. The administrator began, "I hate to start out negative." "Live your best life," Williams said. "Well, we're in this moment of hashtag me too, where it's all about exercising freedom of speech and exorcising demons. So when I thought of silence, it brought up negative connotations." "Well, I had the opposite thought," the editor said. "I went to introspection, peace, pausing to hear the world around me." "Well, there's a yin and yang," the opera singer said. "A what?" the editor said. "A yin and yang," the singer shouted. The women discussed the hashtag Me Too movement, and the men at the table remained silent. When the manager passed by, Williams asked her again to turn down the music. "Already did, sweetie," she said. Presumably, she had not been briefed on Franklin's seventh virtue, sincerity. The group ordered dinner. The consultant, who's Haitian-American, the administrator, who is Chinese-American, and the fundraiser, who is African-American, debated whether Bruno Mars' music was a form of cultural appropriation. "Let's pivot back to our lived experience," Williams says. "In what ways have you felt silenced?" "Silent?" the singer asked. "Silenced," Williams said. "E-D." "What scared me after the 2016 election was how many people silently supported this dude," the fundraiser said. "Just like, yeah, I'm not going to say a word about it, but I agree with him. That made me reconsider a lot of things." "So true," Williams said. He turned to his boyfriend and asked, "Can you expand on that?" He couldn't. His mouth was full of Brussels sprouts. "Okay," Williams said, laughing. "You have the right to remain silent." Continuing in the talk of the town, now the pictures department, an essay entitled Two Sisters by Haley Atwell. Excuse me, by Anthony Lane. What connects Captain America and E.M. Forster? They seem unlikely bedfellows, the shield-toting defender of civilization who is scared of nothing, and the Danish author of Where Angels Fear to Tread. Thanks to the actress Haley Atwell, however, the link has been smartly forged. Having joined the Marvel Cinematic Universe as Peggy Carter in Captain America, the First Avenger, and then in two seasons of ABC's Agent Carter, Atwell has now leapt back in time from America in the wake of the Second World War to London in the years preceding the First. That is the setting for Howard's End, Forster's famous novel about culture, property, gaping class distinctions, and the narrative importance of umbrellas. A four-part dramatization of the book will air on Starz beginning on April 8th. The hub of the tale is the home of two Schlegel sisters, parentless, dauntless, and brimming with a taste for experience. "There's a lack of judgment and a lack of snobbery in them," Atwell said. She was in London, dressed in black, and armed with a Forsterian cup of tea. "They're genuinely original thinkers. They don't seem to be mentally imprisoned by the limitations of that time, and they're not aggressive about their lack of opportunities." She recalled how the director of the series, Hetty MacDonald, came across Schlegel-like figures in photographs from the Edwardian period. "They're blurred because they're action shots," Atwell said. "You see these striding skirts, women smoking cigarettes, heads back, laughing." She plays Margaret, the older sister, who has been a de facto mother to the younger one, the headlong Helen, played by the Australian actress Philippa Coulthard, and to their brother Tibby, played by Alex Lawther. According to Atwell, Margaret's slightly more realistic, and that's reflected in her ability to manage her emotions. Those management skills are tested as the world of the Schlegels enter the orbits of two other families, the lowly Basts and the wealthier Wilcox clan. Notionally headed by Henry, played by Matthew McFadden, the briskest of businessmen, but actually ruled by his indecipherable wife, played by Julia Ormond. Margaret is entranced. She's a proper adult. She finds the differences between her and Mrs. Wilcox fascinating and something to be explored and embraced, Atwell said, adding, "That, for me, was a wonderful experience. To know that our belief systems don't have to be rigid. I felt a lot more comfortable in the possibility that I was wrong. If I say something and someone challenges it, I'm very excited." The same is true of Helen, who visits Howard's End, the Wilcoxes' enviable house, deep in the countryside, and finds her modern ideas of progress and equality being torn to bits by Henry over lunch. Far from being wounded, she relishes the thrill of the dispute. "It was lovely," she reports in a letter. Margaret goes further still, shockingly so, in bridging the gulf between Henry's male capitalist zeal and the early model feminism of the Schlegels. She even takes him to a health food restaurant. Her whole story, in fact, interrogates the norms of now, our proud divisiveness, the allergic reaction to offense. Atwell describes Howard's End as, quote, antisocial media, end quote. The book was filmed for the cinema in 1992 with Emma Thompson as Margaret and Anthony Hopkins as Henry. Atwell, faced with a difficult scene in which, for once, Margaret's composure dissolves, sought advice. "I spoke to Emma Thompson about it. She has a rule that goes, only cry once in a film for maximum impact. Decide where it's going to be. One weep, maybe two, but you have to be very clear about why you're doing it. When I was younger, I was like, isn't acting just about how good I am at crying?" The TV series has two distinct advantages over the movie. One is the contribution of Kenneth Lonergan, whose screenplay for Manchester by the Sea earned him an Academy Award, and who was persuaded to adapt the novel for the new show. "He does write humans well," Atwell said. "As soon as I heard his name mentioned, it was a slam dunk." You can feel the Lonergan touch in the eagerness with which the Schlegels, like many close siblings, talk over one another. "There's the overlapping, but there's got to be the energy that comes with it, and the drive. And unless the actors are on top of it, it's very hard to keep up with what he's actually asking of you," Atwell said. "But when you hit it, it's very satisfying." The second bonus is the long form, 4 hours of watching in all. I was changed in the making of this. It slowed me down, Atwell said. Even in the times when Margaret's not speaking, there's constant thinking going on. There's a huge, rich inner life that's happening. She wants to be out there. She wants to connect. And now from the fiction section, a short story entitled The State of Nature by Camille Bordas. I slept through the burglary. I considered lying about this to the cops when I went to report it. But you don't lie to the police. It's like doctors. They can't help you if you lie to them. I mean, I don't always tell my doctor the whole truth, but that's because my doctor happens to be an old friend. Some things are just too embarrassing to tell your friends. One cop asked if I was unemployed, since I had been taking a nap on a Thursday morning. Well, I'm an ophthalmologist, I said. My schedule varies a lot. She looked at my glasses suspiciously, as if they contradicted what I just told her, as if an ophthalmologist were required to have perfect vision. I wear contacts when I work because patients tend to feel the same way. I told her everything that had been stolen. Most of my living room and a bit of the kitchen were gone. Laptop and flat screen, of course, sound system, but also the Eames chair, the four Hans Wegner Vishvon dining chairs, the two Moroccan rugs I'd brought back from Fez, the two pieces of jewelry I always put on the marble side table, gone as well. When I came home, the china. I didn't care much for the china, and I never used it. It was a gift my parents had received on their wedding day, and the marriage had failed. But I knew it was worth something. And an optometrist case, I said. An antique from the 30s. Does that have any kind of resale value? The cop asked. I said that all the trial lenses had been in mint condition, that someone might pay $1,000, $1,200, maybe, but that mostly it was of sentimental value, since it had been my grandfather's. I'd never met my grandfather, but I omitted that part. That's a widely varied set of items, the cop said, reading over her list. Either the guy knew exactly what he was going to find, or he was pleasantly surprised. Out of curiosity, I asked if the people often slept through burglaries. I hadn't taken a pill, by the way. I'm just a heavy sleeper. People are always amazed at my ability to fall and stay asleep at parties, through construction in the building, at condo meetings. I'm convinced that this corresponds to some ancient tribal trait, some remnant of a time when human activity around you meant safety, that it was safe to sleep, that someone was looking out for the group. My mother says that it's a nice thought, but that I shouldn't trust human activity to mean friendly activity. I should be more wary, have less faith in people. I guess the burglary would prove her point, but then what? There aren't any pills against sleeping too well. It happens, the cop said. Not often, but it happens. I wondered if they had come into the bedroom, how long they'd watched me sleep before deciding if it was safe to carry on. The cop had used the singular, but I pictured two burglars, minimum, what with all the heavy lifting. Mostly, it was worse to imagine only one guy. When I came home, my cat, Catapult, gave me hell and followed me around from room to room to make sure that I wouldn't miss any of her grievances. You could have summoned some of that bitchiness earlier when they came in to steal your bed, I told her. The blue Moroccan rug had been her favorite napping service. It's a bit late to make a federal case of it now. Catapult screamed louder whenever I spoke, so I didn't argue with her any further. Also, yes, I talked to my cat. I think the weird thing is not to talk to your pet, or to expect your pet to answer you, or to talk to your pet when someone else can hear. I'm not insane. I know the cat matters to me, and only to me, so I won't talk about Catapult too much, only when relevant to the story. In fact, maybe I can reveal all of Catapult's arc right now and be done with it. Catapult was not screaming because she missed her fluffy Moroccan rug. She could sleep on anything, even atop the cast iron radiator when it wasn't burning hot, her body sagging into the crinelles. She was pissed because we no longer had a TV. It took me some time to accept it, but that's what it was. Catapult missed Netflix and Larry David, and that was the long and the short of it. I was late to my 3 p.m. appointment because the locksmith thought that I was interested in his life story. It was, in fact, somewhat interesting. His father murdered by his mother, lots of traveling. I just didn't need all the details. As I walked the patient into my office, my secretary handed me his file. I'm usually able to read a patient's file and still catch, out of the corner of my eye, what kind of state he's in. But I got nothing from Mr. Simmons. It was like having a log wearing glasses in my peripheral vision. In his file, I had noted, state of nature guy. I remembered him. Mr. Simmons, I said, coming in to see if your eyesight's remained stable enough the past 12 months for you to try LASIK?
That's correct, he said.
Remind me again why you want LASIK so badly. I didn't need to be reminded. I just enjoyed hearing it.
I don't want to depend on glasses anymore, Simmons explained. They make you look weak, and I don't want to look weak. I want to be ready and have perfect vision when the world collapses, or just the banking system, and we have to go back to the state of nature.
Right, I said, the state of nature.
His eyes shone behind his glasses when I said the words. It had to have been his dream since childhood. Also, he said, I hunt. Glasses get in the way. It would be nice to be able to see my prey better.
I prepared the four-opter with his current prescription. Can you read the second to the last line for me? I said.
E-R-Y.
Don't squint.
Okay, he said after a few seconds and started breathing heavily. I can't read it without squinting. Is that bad?
Don't worry, I said. Just relax. Tell me more about returning to the state of nature, how you see it.
I made changes to the lenses while he spoke. I think I'd be pretty good at the state of nature, he said. And it'd be best for everyone, I believe.
Fairer grounds on which to judge a person's worth. You mean like sheer strength?
His forearms and shoulders hinted at a steady regimen of lifting, pulling, possibly boxing. The rest of him didn't scream tough guy, though. More like IT guy. But that was probably a balance he cultivated.
I mean like intelligence, ability to garden, he said. Good sense of direction will be a plus, too.
I pictured him opening jars for his mom, scaring men away from his sisters by rolling up his sleeves. Happy to do it.
I guess I wouldn't last very long then, I said, and asked him to read from the top.
I'm sure you have some useful skills, Simmons said, which I thought was a little condescending. I mean, I'm a doctor after all, so yeah, I'd hope someone would want me on his team if the time came to make teams.
Females have a tendency to self-deprecate, he went on, but we'll all have a role to play in the new society.
I don't think he believed that. I think what he meant was all who make it will have a role to play, and was only politely pretending that I'd make it.
And if nothing else, he added, your eyesight is good.
When I gave him his new prescription, I almost apologized. Maybe next year, I said. He was so disappointed. On his way out, he pointed at the framed poster I had hung by the door, a black and white version of the Giant Steps album cover.
Didn't Coltrane beat his wife? He asked.
No, not that I know of, no, I said.
He didn't seem to believe me. He didn't seem to believe that beating one's wife was too different from any other personality trait either.
He'd asked in the same tone someone else might have asked, wasn't Coltrane the one who taught his cat to use the toilet? And no, that was Mingus. At my mother's that Sunday, we did lunch every Sunday, I talked about Catapult's still mysterious anger and the locksmith's tragic childhood. My mother shared her general suspicion of black locksmiths,
Certainly, she said. They must have a copy of every single key to every single lock they'd ever installed, or a magic key to all doors. And they entered people's homes to steal small items whose absence wouldn't be noticed for a while. Worse, perhaps a locksmith didn't steal anything, just took naps on beds that weren't theirs, drank out of people's favorite cups, shit in their toilets. Only locksmiths ever had a clue.
In your case, though, it's not a locksmith who did the deed, my mother said. Obviously, we're looking at someone who knows about old optical equipment.
Did you tell the police that?
My mother was glad about the burglary, in a way. She got to use all the knowledge that she'd gleaned from reading crime novels over the past 40 years.
Maybe a former optometrist, she said, blowing her nose and folding the Kleenex neatly over the result. Or a failed one.
Her building had implemented a new waste sorting policy the previous month, and we'd mostly been talking about that. So my burglary provided a welcome change of topic, at least. Just as I was thinking this, though, my mother asked which bin used tissues to go in.
I've been wondering for days, she said. Can snot be recycled?
When in doubt, throw it in the gray bin, I said. My mother doubted a lot. The gray bin was always full.
Well, I can put you in touch with my friend Rita for next week, she said.
Well, what's next week?
Well, like every Sunday, honey, there's the flea market on Pinto Square.
And why would I go there with your friend Rita? I've never heard of Rita.
Don't tell me you don't know about this, my mother said. Everyone who's been burglarized goes to Pinto Square to see if their things resurface. People call it the thieves' market. You never heard that? China, lamps, small furniture, lots of stolen property ends up there. I'm surprised the cop who filed your complaint didn't tell you to go there first thing.
Well, I guess I just didn't look desperate enough to get my stuff back, I said. And I wasn't. Insurance had me covered, and I'd been thinking about getting rid of the TV for a while anyway. I just wasn't sure how to dispose of it responsibly.
Oh, you're getting that case back, my mother said. It's all I have left from your grandfather.
I thought the watch you're wearing was his, and the desk in the library. She simply ignored this. Next Sunday, she said, 9 a.m. sharp, and she gave me Rita's number. Rita, to my surprise, was young. I didn't know where my mother made friends these days. She had a bad fall a few years earlier, and since then she'd decided to limit her outings to what was strictly necessary, a category that didn't include socializing. Rita said that she was an, quote, apartment therapist, end quote, which didn't help me imagine how they might have met. My mother didn't even believe in therapy for people. Rita had told me to bring pictures of the stolen items, but I'd never taken pictures of things. Never really taken pictures in general. So I pulled images of similar objects from the internet and printed them at the office.
Well, I guess these will work, Rita said.
And she sat down on the ground to cut the images out and tape them. She carried scissors and tape in her purse. She taped them into a notebook deformed by dozens of other similar paste-ups. My mother had told me that Rita had started coming to the market after having been burglarized herself years before, and that, giving up on finding her own things, she'd realized she knew how to navigate the place and could be of help to the newly burglarized.
How does that work? I asked Rita. Should I pay you for every Sunday you spend looking, or only when you find something? Didn't your mom tell you, she said? I do this for free.
Well, free things make me suspicious.
Now, you're probably thinking a free service can't possibly be worth much, Rita said, but I'm actually pretty selfish in doing this. I just can't stand knowing that people are suffering while I could help them. There's a lot of suffering here. Your mother told me you were home when they did it.
I was home, too. You're lucky you weren't assaulted. I was. But anyway, I can lighten the burden of others by showing them around, and that's payment enough.
There are more than 300 vendors here, and it can be overwhelming at first. But most of the stolen stuff that enters the market actually ends up on the same 20 to 25 tables, so we'll start with those.
You know which vendors are most likely to resell stolen property, and you don't tell the police about it?
Oh, the police know as much as I do, Rita said, and it's not like the vendors are the actual burglars.
Still, they could lead you to them.
Arresting a couple of vendors will not make the number of burglaries drop, I can tell you that much. The guys would just find new ways to sell their stash, like on the internet, and good luck finding anything there. See, it has a sort of convenience, a thieves' market. People know where to go when they've been robbed. It gives them hope. It keeps things local. And I don't know if you've heard, but local is the future.
She closed the notebook, where she'd taped pictures of my almost things under a dramatic missing headline.
Globalization can only go so far before everything goes to shit. All civilizations go through the same stages before they collapse and break up into smaller groups, you know? I read a very interesting article about it.
Well, how many stages are there? I asked.
9, she said. We're on the 8th.
We started looking. Rita introduced me to a dozen vendors. She gave them only my first name because they didn't need to know my story. Anyone who was there with Rita had the same story. She stopped on occasion to compare a picture in her notebook with something on a table. No match for me or for anyone else. I asked about her job, what it was that an apartment therapist did.
Oh, it's just interior decoration, Rita explained. Basically, except not for people who just moved in, and all are happy about it and have a vision, but for people who've come to hate their place, who feel trapped, who've lost all connection to it. I try to make them like it again, to find the right color for their walls, objects that they can truly bond with.
Would you say you're a good apartment therapist? She thought about it.
Clients are usually satisfied, she said, but some of them relapse after a while. Start accumulating shit and hating everything again. They can't help it. It's the 8th stage I was just telling you about. After abundance and apathy, dependency and bondage.
Well, we weaved through the tables, talked about humanity's impending doom some more, and were offered coffee by a Malian national who sold mostly authentic West African masks and textiles. Akram was his name. Akram noticed that I had cat hair on my sweater and asked many questions regarding Catapult.
How is he taking the burglary? He asked,
and I said that she complained a lot.
Poor baby, Akram said. It must be hard not being able to speak in moments like these.
Rita looked through her purse for a stevia packet for her coffee, and while doing so extracted a plastic whistle. She handed it to me. When I asked what it was for, Rita said that it was a rape whistle.
It's just a whistle, I said. Sometimes the simplest things, Rita said, and didn't finish her sentence, or didn't believe sentences needed verbs.
We didn't find my things, and no one raped us. Rita said not to worry, that it was rare for objects to resurface in the first couple of weeks after a robbery. I was a little annoyed at not having been told this before, having got up early on a Sunday only to face such low odds. When I entered my mother's apartment, she was in motion, a rare phenomenon. When not at work, she usually moved only from reading in bed to reading on the couch.
Photographic paper. Can it be recycled as regular paper?
She held a large manila envelope bursting at the seams.
I wouldn't think so, I said. Isn't it full of chemicals?
Well, your father used to take so many landscape photos, she said, laying the envelope on top of the overflowing gray bin.
I don't get it. Some are nice and all, but it gets pretty repetitive pretty fast. I'm only keeping the pictures with people in them. And then I'll keep the best ones of you in a special envelope.
Well, why would you do that?
I just wanted to know where they are. If there's a catastrophe and I have to flee, people never think to pack pictures in a catastrophe. I mean, except in the movies, of course. And even there, they have to waste crucial time finding them. They're just not part of the go-bag essentials. What's with everyone planning for a major catastrophe these days? Don't you watch the news?
Well, of course I don't watch the news, I said.
Well, that's smart, my mother conceded.
I asked what kind of catastrophe she was preparing for.
Well, I don't imagine anything in particular, she said. Nuclear attack, epidemic, riots.
Well, where would you go?
Or it could just be that I have to go to the hospital in an emergency.
Are you ill?
No, she said, not yet.
I tried to think of what I would put in a go bag, but I blanked. All I could think of was underwear, pens, eye drops, a very sad list.
The thing is, I said, you should probably take your go bag everywhere with you. Catastrophe might strike while you're out shopping. There might be time for you to come. There might not be time for you to come home to pick up your stuff. And there might not even be a home for you to come back to.
Oh, I know that, she said. Don't you think I know that?
That's why my fanny pack is a reduced version of my go bag. Essence of the essential. Come to think, I'm going to have to pick up a single picture of you and slide it in there.
The fanny pack my mother was referring to was a purple tartan monstrosity that my parents had given me to take on some science class trip in middle school. It had rained the whole time, and I'd never worn it. She'd found the fanny pack when sorting through my stuff during the couple of weeks she'd spent bored at home with her broken leg right after her fall.
Such a great invention, she'd said on that phone that day. Do they still make them, or was it just a 90s thing?
I told her that the only two people I'd seen rocking fanny packs in the past 10 years had been jazz musicians.
Well, they know what's up, I guess. It's perfect for a night about town. Could carry cigarettes, mace, even a short novel, maybe, for the subway ride.
I told her that she could keep the fanny pack, because that seemed to be the reason she'd brought the whole matter up, and she'd been wearing it ever since. She didn't walk around conspicuously sporting the fanny pack.
That's how you get mugged, she said,
but concealed it under her sweaters. After her fall, she started wearing ample sweaters, not the lousy kind you see on depressive people, but sweaters of well-shaped ampleness, made of pretty wools. The way they draped over her waist and hips, you would never suspect there was a purple fanny pack under them at all times.
Is Dad okay with you tossing all the pictures he took?
Of course. He said he trusted me to do the sorting and to scan all the ones I deemed essential and send them to him so he can have them for his own go-bag. I assumed my father had merely been polite. I couldn't imagine him packing a go-bag. He'd already lived in the middle of nowhere, the exact sort of place that refugees would flood to in case of a major catastrophe. I guess maybe that's the one scenario, though, in which he'd feel the need to flee. He didn't like people much anymore. My parents divorced the year I went away to college, not out of love for anybody else. Neither of them remarried or even dated afterward. Not that I know of. They just had enough of living with each other, though not with each other so much as with anyone, I think. They're a pair of loners who became attached just long enough to raise a third one. I know people, grown men and women, whose parents worry that they still haven't found the one, or even just one. My parents never broach the topic. They know it's not for everybody.
Can I take a look? I asked.
But I'd already retrieved the manila envelope from the gray bin. After lunch, my mother went back to the novel she was reading, and I went through the photographs at the kitchen table. Lots of trees, indeed. Lots of close-ups of flowers. The West, the Midwest, Mexico. I noticed that the room had got dark at some point, and I thought time had flown. The sun had set. But it was just clouds, nearly black clouds, that wouldn't go away anytime soon. I turned the lights on, and the rain started. The light made me think of how my father, of how sad he'd made me on weekend nights, always working at the same table. He was a lawyer, but often he did all sorts of things for his clients that had nothing to do with the law, like their taxes
the correspondence. He helped out his friends and their friends, too, wrote recommendation letters for them, dealt with their DUIs, things like that. When I was a teenager, he made a big deal of setting up the attic with a state-of-the-art stereo system and a nice leather chair. He said that he had needed a place to relax after work, but because he was never done with work, he never went up there. There was always something extra he could do for someone. Maybe it was during one of those evenings as he was solving a stranger's problems under the pasty kitchen lights, listening to his music on a Discman, that he first devised his plan to become a hermit. I don't blame him. He had to do it. He was too nice to people. They would have eaten him alive if he'd stayed in a well-populated area. The stereo, the records, and the club chair were the only things he took in the divorce. It seemed right to me now, him alone, finally listening to his records, my mother alone, reading, me alone, sorting through landscape photographs of trips I had taken. I selected two photos and threw the rest away again. In one, you can see my parents' shadows ending right at the edge of some orange canyon. And in the other, there's that sequoia tree in the giant forest, which has a hole in it the size of a house. Rita would have kept looking for my things, with or without me. But it felt wrong knowing that she was at the market alone, so I always went with her. Every week, we met at Akram's table for coffee. Akram is always inquired about Catapult. He's the one who said that what she missed was TV. "I fully sympathize with your cat here," he told me. "I don't know what I would do without my shows. And mind you, I see actual people every day. Lots of them. And I still need the fake stories. Your Catapult is home alone most of the time. The people on TV were a big part of her social life."
"But I leave the radio on for her when I go to work," I said.
"Not the same," Akram said. "Can't see the faces. For all your cat knows, the voices are in her head and she thinks she's going crazy."
After 3 months of going there every Sunday, I was starting to know all the vendors. I noticed also the freshly burglarized, carrying pictures of their missing property. Some came to Rita. Some preferred to look on their own. Since I'd met her, Rita had found 9 stolen items, negotiated their prices, and delivered them back to their original owners. They reimbursed her, of course, but also often offered extra compensation and invited her in for coffee, sometimes champagne, which she systematically refused. She didn't do this for a reward, or rather, her reward was to have found the item. There was a flap at the back of her notebook where she kept a stack of white stickers that said, "Found," in red letters. Her favorite thing was to peel off a sticker and paste it above the picture of the object in question, obliterating the missing. It was hard to tell when Rita was happiest, looking or finding. It was obvious that she would still be doing this in 40 years, assuming the world didn't end first, rummaging through piles of objects that didn't yet exist, that hadn't yet been invented. One morning, I saw a vase that my father had brought home from a trip to Mexico. A woman was holding it up in the sunlight for inspection. Her T-shirt said, "Best Mom Ever." I wondered how other mothers felt when they saw such a T-shirt. I could have asked Rita. She had a daughter. I didn't. I pointed at the vase instead. "That was my father's," I said. "Are you sure?" Rita said. "I didn't know your dad had been burglarized." "He wasn't. We gave all his stuff to charity after he left, about 20 years ago."
"Well, I'm so sorry. Your mother never mentioned it."
"Oh, he hasn't vanished or anything," I said. "He has a phone and all, somewhere in the woods. My mother and him still talk." I knew by then that my mother and Rita had met at the hospital, my mother's fall having occurred the same day Rita had been assaulted by her burglars. They didn't see much of each other, but they spoke on the phone, often, according to my mother, and I found it strange that she had never mentioned my father. "My dad's not big on owning stuff anymore," I told Rita, "so it's weird to see something of his." I saw Simmons then.
my state of nature patient, looking at a display of knives two tables up. I was wearing my glasses and didn't want the secret of my bad eyesight revealed, but the moment I thought this, our eyes met. Of course, I can't tell for sure what happened then. I'm not the best at reading people, and it all went too fast for deep analysis. But anyway, I think he panicked. He broke eye contact right away and disappeared into the crowd. "Do you want to get it?" Rita asked me, her thoughts still on my father's face. I said I didn't, and Rita bought it herself. Just in case you change your mind. You'll know where to find it. The woman in the Best Mom Ever t-shirt, who'd previously coveted the vase, was now wondering if she'd made a mistake in discarding it. "Why doesn't your daughter ever come here?" I asked Rita. "Oh, she's better at home with her dad. This place is too depressing. You can't bring a kid here." It felt rude to note that there were tons of families walking around. "And I don't want her to see me as this loser," she added. "What loser? You're not a loser." "Honey, of course I'm a loser. You're a loser too, by the way. We're all here looking to pay a second time for stuff we already own. I mean, we can't let go of things. Things that it took a stranger a minute to take away from us and profit from. They're the winners. The market was nicknamed for them, not us. If someone was writing an essay on the thieves' market, they would be the thrill. We'd be interviewed, maybe, for color, for laughs. But we're the losers here. Losers, A to Z." She was smiling while saying this, but her eyes still teared up. "I thought you'd given up on finding your things," I said. "I thought you weren't really looking anymore." "Well, I'm not," she said. "Not really, but it's always somewhere in the back of my head. You never know when things will resurface." I thought about buying my father's vase back from her immediately so she could at least feel, in that moment, that we shared the burden of loserdom. But then I didn't. I didn't even want my own things back. On Mondays that winter, I had been taking shifts at the ER for ocular emergencies. After my shift, I'd got in the habit of heading to The Cave, a jazz club a few blocks from the hospital. The music wasn't great there. They rarely saved the best lineups for Mondays, but the pours were generous. Simmons was at the bar when I came in that Monday, and at first I thought it was a weird coincidence. Two chance encounters in just 2 days. "But he'd been waiting for me," he said. I couldn't remember mentioning working at the ER to him or going to the jazz club afterward, but maybe stalking was part of the training he'd devised to ensure his survival. Or maybe he'd called my office. Maybe my secretary had given him my schedule. "I owe you an explanation," he said, "about what happened yesterday. I shouldn't have run away like that. That was cowardly. Let me buy you a drink." What had caused Simmons to run away from me at the market hadn't been my wearing glasses, but his not wearing his. He thought that I'd noticed, even though, in the course of examining patients, I end up seeing them without their glasses more often than with. "I went to see this other ophthalmologist," Simmons explained, "and he said it was okay to get the LASIK, even though my vision hadn't been stable for 12 months. And, you know, that's what I always wanted to hear, so I went for it. I felt wrong proceeding against your advice, and I'm sorry, but, well, not that sorry, because it worked. I have perfect vision now. I mean, near perfect." "Well, congratulations," I said. I didn't tell him to enjoy it while it lasted. "You're not mad that I didn't follow your medical opinion?" Simmons said. "I feel really guilty." "I'm happy for you," I said. "Now you can just relax and wait for the world to collapse." "Well, thank you," he said. "In the meantime, though, and don't tell my girlfriend this, I feel like getting the surgery is the best decision I've ever made. I shot 6 ducks in a day last week. Personal best." He'd confessed to having got LASIK and to having a girlfriend before I'd even ordered a drink. I didn't really see a reason for us to hang out anymore, but I still pounded my scotch and ordered a second one. We talked about the different ways he was preparing for the state of nature. He knew how to build a fire with just sticks, and not only how to shoot, but also how to make his own bow and arrows. And over the third drink, I mentioned my father and his self-sufficient life in the woods. Simmons asked me for his email,
and I asked him if his girlfriend, whom he'd referred to as Kay, was looking forward to the state of nature as much as he was.
"She says she has to get laser hair removal before it happens, and then she'll be all set," he said.
"She doesn't think pants will still be easy to come by?"
I think it's for her own comfort.
"What's her name again?"
"Kay," Simmons said.
"I mean her whole name.
Katie."
"What's Katie short for?"
"Oh, probably Catherine, don't you think, or Caitlin?"
"Don't ask me."
"I guess her mother is Russian, though. Could be Katya.
Or Ekaterina," I said.
"Wow, you think so?"
He had to pee, and while he was in the bathroom, I thought about how Kay would probably not become his wife. Not until death did them part, at least. And about how no one ever stayed together forever, and how unsad that was. The jazz trio had been playing since we'd come in, wrapped up its first set. The bass player grabbed a mic and said, "Guys, we'll take 5 and be back in 15, which was a joke you get the feeling he'd made every night of his performing life. It still got a couple of laughs. The drummer got up from behind his toms, and sure enough, he was wearing a fanny pack. I was drunk enough that I flirted with him when he stood by me at the bar. One thing I know about jazz musicians is that they can never believe it when someone who's not a jazz musician talks to them. "Where do you buy a fanny pack these days?" I asked the drummer.
"Well, this one has a very special history," he said.
"Like," he said, his ponytail brushing against his cheek as he leaned forward, "it's no accident that the first thing you wanted to talk to me about was my fanny pack. Fanny packs must mean something special to you. Mine made you think we might have a connection."
"Well, my mother wears one," I said. I understood something then, all at once, why my mother wore a fanny pack.
The drummer kept talking while I tried to write a message to my mother, apologizing for having only now come to understand what had happened to her, letting her know that we could talk about it if she wanted, or that we could also never talk about it, but that in her way, her sending me to Rita might have meant that deep down she was ready to talk about it now, with me, or so it seemed. It couldn't be that she just wanted a stranger to give me a rape whistle, could it? Well, actually, maybe it could. Maybe I was overstepping. Probably, I thought. Probably overstepping. If my mother had wanted me to know she'd been assaulted, she would have said something. She would have been direct. I could just send her a text about this in the middle of the night. Actually, I could, but I shouldn't. Or maybe I should. And in fact, no, I couldn't either. There wasn't any cell reception in the club. I tried to send the message, but the delivery had failed. If that wasn't a sign that I shouldn't send it, it was at least a guarantee that I wouldn't send it until later.
That guy's creepy," Simmons said. "He'd got rid of the drummer while I'd been typing. Did he bother you? Are you all right?"
"Let's get out of here," I said. We went to the CVS across the street to buy some Alka-Seltzer in anticipation of our separate hangovers, and because we were drunk, we looked at every item in the store that was more than 3 different colors at once. Simmons tried some juggling balls, and I compared 2 different fanny packs. He told me just to go with my gut. I chose the one that had the most pockets, and he offered to buy it for me.
"Could come in handy one day," he said.
At the register, I picked up a DVD of the 3rd season of The Walking Dead to watch on my computer with Catapult. We'd seen the first 2 seasons, but I didn't think she'd care. Simmons said that it wasn't the most realistic as far as survivalist works of fiction went, and that it was still too bathed in American puritanism, too shy in coming to terms with the speed at which morality would disappear in the event of a zombie apocalypse, but that there was still some useful information to pick up from the show.
"If anything, it teaches you to do exactly the opposite of what the characters do."
On the sidewalk, we divided the contents of the Alka-Seltzer box, and I put my 24 packets in my new fanny pack. Simmons hailed a cab for me, but I said I preferred to walk.
"Well, you're not walking home drunk in the middle of the night," he said. "Not on my watch."
I told him that I'd done it before, that I was a responsible adult, and that I had a whistle.
"Nonetheless," he said, "you should be more careful."
"I am careful," I said.
"Well, you should be more afraid then."
I accepted the cab, and before he closed the door on me, Simmons said he would see me next year for his checkup, if I still wanted him as a patient. I didn't tell him that his eyesight would likely start deteriorating again before then. I was so dizzy in the car that I told the driver to drop me off a couple of blocks before my building. I needed to walk the rest of the way, no matter what Simmons thought. It was freezing out, and it hurt to breathe, but everything stopped spinning at least, and I had more balance now. And being aware of my balance made me aware of the stillness all around me and the silence. I don't love silence much. It's easy to break. It's one of the reasons I don't visit my father in the woods too often. I can't fall asleep there. I can't tell you why I blew the whistle. Nothing was threatening, only the possibility that the silence might be broken. And I guess that I may have had this idea, that if I was the one to break it, it would be all right, or not as bad. What would be all right, though? What would not be as bad? I don't know. I didn't blow the whistle to get attention, or at least I don't think I did. I didn't really think about it. All I know is that I blew it, and nothing changed. No one came. Well, we have a few minutes for some cartoons in the New Yorker. The first one shows a double-decker sightseeing bus filled with people on the top deck in New York City, and the tour operator is speaking into the microphone and says, "And coming up on the right is another area ruined by the likes of you." Finally, one more cartoon. We see a group of people standing outside a hospital room with an old man in the hospital bed. There are the two female doctors speaking to the family, two men and a woman. And the female doctors say, "We're doing everything we can to make him comfortable, short of dressing up as male doctors." Well, sounds like we're out of time for today's New Yorker broadcast for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I hope you'd enjoyed it as much as I have. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleradioreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. And so, until next time, it's been a pleasure reading to you today. I'm Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.